today, I had on my mind to do a repeat, and I haven't done this before, so it feels a little bit odd, but what I spoke about in Oklahoma City, I feel strongly is something that I'd like to speak on here in Oxford. And although I want to take a little different approach as I go forward with it, but I'm going to start by simply saying that if there's a subject that I would put on this, the subject would be the first part of Hosea 11:1, when Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. But when Israel was a child, then I loved him. And I want to start by going to the book of Acts, and I want to go to chapter 13. And this is there's a beautiful sermon that the Apostle Paul preaches here, but to give it a little bit of context, back in Acts chapter 7, Stephen, who was ordained as a deacon in chapter 6, in chapter 7, was preaching to a group of Jewish people, including the Apostle Paul before he was Paul, when he was Saul. And at the end of that sermon is a beautiful sermon, and walks you through really the history of the Israelites as in all the significant events, or many of the, it's a summary of many of the significant events. And at the end of that, he's stoned to death because they did not like his message. And it is not unlike the same sermon here in Acts chapter 13. There's a whole lot of similarities between the two, but this is preached by the very man who stood there while Stephen was being stoned to death for preaching what he later in Acts 13 preaches to the Jews. And I think that that's a very interesting. So Acts chapter 7 is the Stephen sermon, and then Acts chapter 9 is when Paul has his experience as Saul, starting as Saul, on the road to Damascus. And now we are here in Acts 13. So that should give you a little bit of context. And I want to go, let's start with verse 14. So 13:14 of Acts, we're going to read about four or five verses here. But when they departed from Perga, they came to Antioch in Pisidia and went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. Now this is Paul and Barnabas. All right. And so they are traveling. They have gone to Antioch. They've been other places before this. But they go into the synagogue. So the temple in that area, the worship. And after the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent unto them, saying, "Ye men and brethren, if ye have any word of exhortation for the people, say on." So not unlike what we just offered a few minutes ago, any of the men could stand up and speak. That's what's being offered here after they completed a certain part of the service. Verse 16, then Paul stood up and beckoning with his hand said, "Men of Israel, and ye that fear God, give audience." So he's asking people to pay attention and listen. "The God of this people of Israel," so the God of Israel, "choose our fathers and exalted," I'm sorry, let me back up. "The God of this people of Israel chose our fathers," and he is referring to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, when he makes that comment, "and exalted the people," exalted the Israeli people, "when they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt. And with an high arm brought he them out of it. So what he starts here with in his sermon that goes on for the rest of this chapter, and I actually want to come back to this a little bit later, but I want to emphasize, chose our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and exalted the people of Israel while they were strangers in the land of Egypt. So when the Jewish people were being held in Egypt, this is after Joseph had done all the wonderful things as the governor or the right-hand man of the king of Egypt, and they prospered greatly, but then they ended up later as slaves, and they dwelt as strangers, meaning they didn't belong there. All right? They didn't belong in Egypt. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. And with a high arm, meaning from the good Lord, brought he them out of the land that they, from which they did not belong. So let's talk a little bit about Egypt. What does Egypt represent? If we go to Genesis chapter 9, now Genesis chapter 9 is after the flood, or at the back end of the flood. Now you go back into Genesis chapter 6, and we read about the evil that existed in the world and how terrible it was. And then later on in Matthew chapter 24, Jesus refers to the perilous times. He doesn't say it that way. We know in 2 Timothy chapter 3, it says at the end times, perilous times will come. And Jesus actually references Genesis chapter 6 about the evil in the world. So Jesus talks about that in light of that being like the end times. And we see a lot of that in the world that we live in today. And we all know that, and we're frustrated with those things that we see. But if I go to chapter 9, and we'll start with the first verse, read a couple, and then go on down further. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air and upon that moveth upon the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered, meaning they're in charge. They'll be in charge of this, you know, replenishing the earth. So if we go down to verse 18, and the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. Now Canaan is the land that eventually the good Lord took the Israelites and they crossed the Jordan over into Canaan. And it says here, he's the father of Canaan, meaning he was one of the ancestors of the people in Canaan. Verse 19, these are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. So imagine, everything has been washed away in the great flood. All the evil is gone. There's Noah, eight souls, there's Noah and his three sons, their wives, his wife, and we're talking about the three sons. And Noah began to be an husbandman, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and was drunken, and he was uncovered within his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward and they saw not their father's nakedness. Now, clearly Ham did, because he came out and told them about it. Ham's behavior was unacceptable. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. And of course, this is a lot of what we see in the world around us today, is this exact thing. And look how quickly it happened after the flood, after the great evidence that they would have seen of God Almighty's hand, and yet disobedience. The depravity of man. It's just there, and we can't help it because of the fall of Adam. And he said, being Noah, verse 25, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." So he's basically relegating Canaan, Ham, to a lesser role, to a servant's role. And Noah lived after the flood 350 years, etc. So there's a curse that's been put on Ham right here. And this curse relates directly to the land of Egypt. So if we go to Genesis chapter 12, so we turn a couple of pages over, and Genesis chapter 12 is really the start of the story of Abram, i.e. Abraham later. And actually the first mention of Abram is in chapter 11, at the end of chapter 11. But chapter 12 is really the beginning of the story. I really love this chapter because it's telling Lord's dealing with his chosen, the beginnings of his chosen people. "Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house and into a land that I will show thee, and I will make thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing." Now, I want to go down to verse 10, but I just want to comment briefly about, "Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred." The good Lord reached down to Abram and said, "You need to leave where you are. I've got something I need you. I'm going to have you do something. You are going to do what I ask you to do. I want you to get up and leave." And I will liken this to, in our lives, we have those kinds of things that happen to us. I feel like in some ways, for Cindy and I, moving to Kansas from Texas was something along those lines. I'm not trying to equate it to what God was doing with Abram, but we're all faced with those kinds of things. And I'm going to comment that Sister Angie making her foray over to Missouri, and she has a mission that God has put on her heart that she is doing, and her men here are supporting her and helping her in that. And that's what we are to do when God calls us to do something. And it's important to understand that's exactly what's happening with Abram here. Now, if we go down to verse 10, "And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. And it came to pass, when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarah, his wife, Behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. Therefore it shall come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they shall say, This is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive." So they'll get rid of Abram out of the picture, because they would want to his wife. Verse 13, "Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee." So he's basically saying, tell them you're my sister, so they're not going to see me competing with them for your interest. Now, this is a half-truth. It's not a whole lie, but it's a half lie or a half truth. In essence, it's a lie. And it came to pass that when Abram was come into Egypt, and I'm not going to go into the half-truth because that's going to take too long, but Abram was come into Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman that she was very fair. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her, and commended her before Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. So Sarah was taken into her house. And he entreated Abram well for her sake, because thought they were brother and sister. And he had sheep and oxen, and he asses, and men servants, and maid servants, and she asses and camels. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this that thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me that she was thy wife? What saidest thou? She is my sister, so I might have taken her to me to wife. Now therefore, behold thy wife, take her and go thy way, because I'm suffering a lot of bad stuff, and I don't want to continue this." And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, meaning Abram, and they sent him away and his wife and all that he had. So he gave him two things when he left Egypt. He gave him great riches, and that's listed in verse 16, what he gave them. And he gave him what? A handmaiden, maid servants. The two things that Abe, and there's a long story here, and we're not going to go through all of it, but he got two things out of Egypt when he left Egypt. And what were the two things? Two things that caused him great tribulation and trouble going forward. One being the riches over which he and Lot ended up separating and splitting up. And that caused the whole story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and that's a whole nother example, if you will, of Egypt. And the other thing he got was a handmaiden who ended up having a son, Ishmael, who to this very day is causing problems in the world. Because why? Because he decided, Sarah and he decided, that they needed to help God with the promise of the promised seed that was coming. And that's what happens when we try to help God. And I would also say, and I've said this many times before, and I've learned this the hard way, and I've said it here before, so you will recognize this. When you try to predict what God's going to do, you will almost always be 180 degrees wrong. Because whatever he does is so above us that we can't predict that. And this, in essence, is them trying to take that into their own hands, believing that they were helping God because God somehow needed their help, and yet God had a complete different, 180 degrees different plan for him. This is what Egypt represents, by the way. Egypt represents darkness. It represents the treasures of the world. It represents idolatry. Those are all the things that Egypt represents in the Bible. Now, how do we know that? Well, there's several ways we can know it. Obviously, from some of the things we've read, some of the problems we see with Abraham. But if we go to Psalm 78, verse 51, "And smote all the firstborn in Egypt, the chief of their strength in the tabernacles of Ham." All right, the tabernacles of Ham. Egypt, Ham is the father of Egypt. Ham had a curse on him. And he was the father of Egypt, the father of Canaan, the people that moved into Canaan over time. Idolatry flourished through all of that. There's so much to speak of. But we can also go over to Psalms 105 and verse 23. "Israel also came into Egypt Israel came into Egypt, and Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. And he increased his people greatly, they grew greatly, and made them stronger than their enemies. He turned their heart to hate his people to deal subtly with his servants. He sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen. They showed his signs among them and wonders in the land of Ham. Again, confirmation, the land of Ham, Egypt, curse on Egypt. And if we go to Psalms 106, verse 22, wondrous works in the land of Ham and terrible things by the Red Sea. Now this is referencing what God did with the 10 plagues. Those were the wondrous works in the land of Ham and the terrible things by the Red Sea. So the source of Egypt being evil comes from that curse on Ham that we described at the very beginning. Now I will tell you that any time that the Bible talks about Egypt, somebody going to Egypt, it's going down to Egypt. Down, down, down to Egypt. People come out of Egypt, but when they go to Egypt, they're going down. And it's a representation of the world that we live in. Okay? And the world is going, the world we see is going down, down, down. But we can rejoice because we have an understanding that the good Lord has put in our hearts, that if you are a child of God, you're going to be saved from all of what is to come. One of the other things that that I want to comment on is that Abraham never once built an altar while he was in Egypt. If you read the whole story of Abraham, he builds altars all over the place. Why does he build an altar? To worship God. Alright? But he doesn't build one in Egypt. Alright? And is it not a shadow of the church, not being part of the world? That's what we have here. In the church is the same thing in essence as the altar, a place to worship God in truth. Now we know the whole story of Abraham, Jacob, Joseph. Joseph obviously one of Jacob's sons. What happened to him? He went down into Egypt, and he ended up being the source of how good things came from his being there, but ultimately the Israelites went into slavery. And as a result of that, they were in a bad situation. So I want to go to, let's talk about coming out of Egypt for a moment. Let's go to Exodus, and we're going to start with chapter 4. And then we're going to go over to chapter 12, or 11 and 12. But chapter 4, I want to go to verse 22. Let me back up, verse 20. And Moses took his wives and sons. Now, in the previous chapter, Moses was in front of the burning bush when God told him what he was to go do to save his people. All right? And his people were in Egypt. And he was sending Moses, what? Down to Egypt in order to save his people. His chosen people. And right here it says, and Moses took his wife and his sons and set them upon an ass, and he returned to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the rod of God in his hand. And we haven't read about the rod of God, but God used the rod, which was something Moses had, to affect the 10 plagues that occurred later on, that we're not going to go through all the details. And the Lord said unto Moses, when thou goest to return into Egypt, see that thou do all these wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in thy hand, meaning the rod, but I will harden his heart that he shall not let the people go. So Moses is going on a mission that God sent him on, with this rod, and he's headed out to do exactly what God has asked him to do. And he's saying, you're going to go down there, but I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. And he's not going to let the people go. It isn't going to be easy. It isn't going to be easy. And thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. Now, I started with Hosea 11:1. When Israel was a child, then I loved him. That's a prophecy that pulls from this event, but points toward Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 2, which we're eventually going to get there. But this right here is declaring Israel is my son, even my firstborn, meaning that I love Israel the same as I love my firstborn. Israel was God's chosen people. This is a shadowing of the doctrine of election that we hold to in the Primitive Baptist Church. These were God's elected people. They didn't do anything to get this. God chose them. And I say unto thee, let my son go, that he may serve me, and if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn. Now we know in the end of the whole 10 plagues that it ended up with Pharaoh's son dying because his heart was hardened. But I want to go on and I want to talk about a couple of verses beyond this that I found interesting. And it's a little bit of an aside. Verse 24, and it came to pass by the way in the end that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. So that's interesting. Moses is doing what he was asked to do, and he had been told to do it in front of the burning bush in the previous chapter, and he was on his way to do what he had been told to do. And it came to pass, by the way, in the end, that the Lord met him. The Lord met him while he was at this end and sought to kill him. Now, first thought was, that doesn't make sense. You chose Moses. You said, go do this. He's doing it. And now you sought to kill him. And then you got to question yourself, if God wanted to kill him, did he actually have to show up right there? No. God could have just zapped him from wherever. Verse 25, then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet and said, surely a bloody husband art thou to me. So he let him go. Then she said, a bloody husband thou art because of the circumcision. Then the Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. So there's this little seemingly strange event that occurs here. And I read the commentaries on this, and I called Brother Allen and I talked to him about it. And what this is referring to is that when you're called to go do something, you need to make sure you're doing everything the right way. All right? And Moses had neglected the circumcision of his evidently youngest son, doesn't tell us which one here, but the youngest one is most logical. And he had neglected that. He hadn't done it. And Zipporah, in order to save her husband, did it quickly. And it was obeying what God wanted and expected. I think it was also a message to both of them that you've got an important job to do and you need to go do it. And Zipporah, you need to support him in that effort. That's somewhat of my thoughts added into that. But that's, as I said, that's a little bit of an aside. Now, if we go to Exodus chapter 11, I'd like to read all 10 of these verses, but we're not going to have time and probably shouldn't. But it starts, and the Lord said, verse 1, said unto Moses, yet will I bring one plague more upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards he will let you go thence. Hence, when he shall let you go, he shall surely thrust you out hence altogether. And this, if we go down to verse 5, this is the 10th plague, the firstborn. And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sitteth upon the throne, even unto the firstborn of the maidservant that is behind the mill, and all the firstborn of the beast. And there shall be a great cry throughout the land of Egypt, such as there was none like it, nor shall be like it any more. But against any of the children of Israel shall not a dog move his tongue against man or beast, that you may know how that the Lord doth put a difference. The Lord put a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. The Lord puts a difference between the world, his non-elect, and his elect. He puts a difference between them. And all these thy servants shall come down unto me and bow down. I'm going to not go further for the sake of time. But right here is where the beginning of the Israelites coming out of Egypt. When Israel was a child, then I loved him. Israel was a child. This was early in the time of the Israelites. And that's what Hosea is referring to in the first part of that verse, 11:1. When Israel was a child, then I loved him. Now we can go to chapter 12, and it talks right here, and the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak ye unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the 10th day of this month, they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for a house. I spoke about this about 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago when I talked about the Passover and the Last Supper, and how this is a shadowing of exactly what Jesus did for us. And right here, right after we after they come out of Egypt, or they start out of Egypt, God gives them this instruction. And this lamb that's referred to as Jesus Christ, it's a representation of Jesus Christ. So all of this ties together. Now over in Luke 22, which I'm not going to go to, that's where the Last Supper, that's one of the accounts of the Last Supper that I spoke to a few weeks ago. So let's go to Deuteronomy 4:19. So Deuteronomy is just a couple of books over, and we're going to go to chapter 4, verse 19. Now, Deuteronomy is the last of the books written by Moses of the five books. And Deuteronomy, deuce means do over again, second time around. And that's what Deuteronomy really is. It's Moses, before he dies, going back through everything that had happened to the people of Israel previously. And so God knew that they needed a reminder at this point in time. And it's amazing how many times we have to be told something for us to understand it and obey it and keep it. Let's see, I wanted to go to verse 19, if I can find it here. Unless thou lift up thine eyes unto heaven, and when thou seest the sun and the moon and the stars, even all the host of heaven. Now, Moses is talking to the Jewish people. And he's saying, whenever you lift your eyes up unto the heaven, and when thou seest the sun and the moon and the stars, even all the host of heaven, shouldest be driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord thy God hath divided unto all nations under the whole heaven. He's saying, you look and you see these things, and you almost want to worship the sun and the moon and all of these things. But he's saying, I'm the one that put those up there. You need to worship me. But the Lord hath taken you, and here's how he really underscores it. But the Lord hath taken you and brought you forth out of the iron furnace, even out of Egypt. He's taken them out of Egypt. This is out of Egypt. To be unto him a people of inheritance as ye are this day. So here in Deuteronomy, Moses is reiterating to them what God did for the Israeli people, the Israelites, the Jewish people, his chosen elect people, took them out of Egypt, out of the iron furnace. If we go to, very quickly, Deuteronomy 32, verse 8, two verses here. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. He's talking about when Israel was a child. When Israel was a child, then I loved him. He took them out in verse 10. He found him in a desert land and in the waste howling wilderness. He led him about. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. Now, Israel's often referred to as Jacob, or Jacob is referred to in many cases as being Israel. And we know that when Joseph was taken out of Egypt, they even took his bones out of Egypt, completely out of Egypt. Nobody, no Jewish people were buried in Egypt. Okay. So this is a beautiful picture of election. If we go to 1 Kings, chapter 8, verse 51. For they be thy people and thine inheritance, which thou broughtest forth out of Egypt from the midst of the furnace of iron. Are we seeing a theme here? Are we seeing a theme here? That thine eyes may be open unto the supplication of thy servant and unto the supplication of thy people Israel, to hearken unto them all that they call for unto thee. For thou didst separate them from among all the people of the earth, separated them, put a difference between them, to be thine inheritance, as thou speakest by the hand of Moses, thy servant, when thou broughtest our fathers out of Egypt, O Lord God. When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. So if we go very briefly to Hosea, chapter 11, and I've been quoting this verse, but I want to give you a little bit of context. Hosea is a prophet called a minor prophet. Don't know how you call anybody minor who's got a book in writings in a book that's lasted for centuries and centuries and centuries. But if we just very quickly pick up verse 17. Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Now what Hosea is, that's in verse 4, but now we're going to go over to 11, but I wanted to read that because Ephraim was one of the 12 tribes of Israel, which is outlined back in Genesis chapter 49. In a prophecy that Jacob put forth. Ephraim is one of the largest, if not the largest tribe in the northern kingdom. So Israel, 12 tribes, and at a certain point in time, they split into the upper 10 and the lower 2. The upper 10 are the ones that, where Ephraim was located physically. That's why it was up higher, is the way I'm trying to describe it. And Judah and Benjamin were the lower two. Judah is the tribe from which Jesus Christ came from the natural side of the man side of Jesus. And but the upper 10 tribes were often referred to as Ephraim because it's one of the largest, and they've been turned to idolatry. So this is not when they're young anymore. This is when they have turned to idolatry. And Hosea wrote this roughly about 750 BC, somewhere in that time frame. Hosea was a contemporary with Isaiah and was, you know, one of, and had a long period of time over which that he prophesied in the northern kingdom. And he was talking about the idolatry. Now Judah and Benjamin also went the same way the ten tribes did, but it was much later, 150 years or so later. So Hosea's writing this about 30 years or so, roughly, before the Assyrians came in and took over and defeated the ten tribes and dispersed them forever thereafter. So he's warning Israel. And he's telling them when Israel was a child. So way back when you guys were at the very beginnings, then I loved him and I called my son out of Egypt, my son, Israel. We know that he called Israel his son. But at the same time, this is prophesying the coming of Jesus Christ, or prophesying Jesus Christ. So if we go to Matthew chapter 2, and if I had a lot of time, I'd like to read all of this, but what we know is, let's go on down to, verse 11. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child. This is the three, wise men, so-called wise men. This is not when he was a baby in the manger. This was 2 or 3 years. We don't know exactly how long, but years later, because we're now talking about a young child, not a baby. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshiped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, because Herod had said, you know, go down there, find out where Jesus is, and come tell me, because he had evil designs. They got a dream that said that don't return to Herod. They departed into their own country another way. So they didn't go back to where King Herod was. And when they were departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeareth to Joseph. This is Joseph, Mary's husband, in a dream, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother and flee where? Into Egypt. And be thou there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. And when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed into Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that he might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, referring to Hosea right here, saying, out of Egypt have I called my son. His son that would sacrifice himself for God's elect chosen people. He called his son out of Egypt just like he called his people out of Egypt. And you see this connection between the old, the prophecy in the middle, and the fulfillment of that prophecy in Jesus Christ. And how can you not believe this book when all of it connects that much with 40 different authors that have written this book over 1600 years? If we go to go back to Acts, and I want to close. Let's go to Acts chapter 13, and we'll go. I'm going to skip a lot of this sermon from Paul where I started in the beginning. Let's see. I'll go to verse 36. For David, after he had served his own generation, this is Paul preaching again to the Jews in that synagogue. For David, after he had served his own generation by the will of God, fell on sleep and was laid unto his fathers and saw corruption. But he whom God raised again saw no corruption. What he's referring to is that David died and Jesus was the seed of David, which was one of the prophecies that we haven't touched on directly. Be it known unto you, therefore, men and brethren, that through this man is preached unto you the forgiveness of sin through Paul, this man, and by him all that believe are justified from all things from which ye could not be justified by the law of Moses. The law of Moses couldn't do it, declare people just. It is only by justified from all from which ye could not, and by him all that believe, talking about Jesus Christ. Beware therefore lest that come upon you which is spoken of in the prophets. Behold, ye despisers, and wonder and perish, for I work a work in your days, a work which you shall no wise believe, though a man declare it unto you. Meaning you're a bunch of despisers and you don't believe this. I'm doing this work. And when the Jews were gone out of the synagogue and the Gentiles besought that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath, the Gentiles loved it and they wanted to hear it preached to them again and again. And there's so much more to go in here, but I don't have time. So I want to go to 1 Timothy chapter 3, and I want to close here. 1 Timothy. So what I was referring to was the establishment, was the continuation through Paul's preaching and the other apostles, and it going to the Gentiles, the church. Jesus Christ, true church. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 14, these things write I unto thee, this is Paul again writing to Timothy, hoping to come unto thee shortly. But if I tarry long, if it's going to be a while before I get there, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of truth. The pillar and ground of truth. And that is what we have right here in this small gathering in this church in Oxford, Kansas right now. Thanks be to God. And we wouldn't know it if it wasn't for his book.